Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his partner in crime, Duncan Nicol.
I was going to be very interested, Duncan, about when you said partner in crime, which one were you positioning yourself as? Because on one hand, I'd say you're definitely like the smart one of the group, considering that you're an engineer and I do admin work. On the other hand, I was like, I don't know if he wants to compare himself to like the half the other guy's height, weedy little 5 foot nothing guy.
Do you know what? Am I the Grey Mouser or am I Fafnir? That's a good question. I would still go with Grey Mouser, but I don't want to be casting you then as the brutish sword wielding northern boy.
I'm definitely not the northern boy, as anyone who's now listening to my voice can say. Although, I guess I've always lived north of you. As we've discussed in another podcast, you have only ever had to learn three cardinal directions because you live on the south coast.
That is very much the case. As is the case today, we're talking about Fafnir and the Grey Mouser, if you are wondering.
Before we go any further, Duncan, I can confirm. I've checked. I've done thorough research, and the book spelt it out. The character's name is Fafnir. It's not, as I was worried, Fafnir. It's definitely not Fufuf, as I speculated last time. It's Fafnir, the most obvious way of pronouncing it.
I really appreciated the bit in the book where the characters literally go, "So how do you pronounce that?" And he goes, "Fafnir." And then I still got it wrong, because my brain is a sieve these days. Geordie, before we get into this Sword and Sorcery adventure that we're reviewing today, the first Fafnir and the Grey Mouser ever published, although not the first chronological one, Ill-Met in Lankmar, have you been reading, experiencing, watching anything else, fantasy or non-fantasy, you want to share with us?
Not really. I literally finished editing the previous episode yesterday. I haven't really had time to read or experiencing anything else. The one thing I will say, even though it's not strictly speaking from the last week, which I think I want to bring up, is that both Duncan and I have had a new fantasy experience because we've now played a new role-playing game. Haven't we, Duncan?
We have indeed. Draw Steel. It's been really
fun. By MCDM. Yeah, so I was following the production of this for a long time. I was about to say Kickstarter, but it wasn't Kickstarter. It was a different alternative. But it's run by MCDM Productions, who are the Matt Colville RPG company. People may be familiar with his YouTube videos. I think he's a really great communicator about role-playing games. And it turns out he makes good role-playing games. I didn't really like his supplements for Dungeons & Dragons before, but I really like running Draw Steel, and Duncan, you seem to enjoy playing it.
I really do. It's a very different, I say very different, it's a shake-up to sort of the classic 5e D&D rule set that we're all familiar with, without being too far away that it comes kind of alien and kind of hard to learn. You've got a lot of very similar archetypes. When we were sort of doing the character selection, you know, I was like, so that's a paladin with a different name. It's like, yes, okay, and that's your rogue. Yep, got it. But the actual moment-to-moment gameplay, or at a glance, being almost identical, has a very different feel to it.
Could you speak to a little bit? Because I've only run it so far, and I'm also the one who's like read the rule books and all that, can you give me a little bit of insight into like what does it feel like to be learning a new system like that? What are the friction points? What makes you go, ooh, yeah, that's cool?
So what's really cool about this game, and like I think the thing that would jump out to people, is that you don't roll a die to have like a percentage chance of hitting. You always hit. You always make contact with the enemy. It's simply a matter of how much damage you deal. Where this plays in is the fact then you never have that scenario, and I had it once, and you know, I was playing, I think I was low level, Dungeon of the Mad Mage. I was a cleric. And I like let off a, whatever it's called, a sacred ray or blast or whatever it was. I missed. And then it was just like, okay, I will wait the 15 minutes for the remaining 5 people I'm playing with and all the monsters to go and see if I hit again. Like, that's gone. You always have like a level of engagement in combat. What you also have is a real, so this game, we played exclusively with a board and tile set. I believe you would have to, because it's much more focused.
Yeah, you have to play. You have to play with a board. You couldn't play Theatre of the Mind because movement is so important to the game. And like shoving people around, sliding them, knocking them over, cursing them, distances, they're way too important. So if you weren't playing it online like we were, you would have to actually buy like mats and tokens and things like that, and it would probably get more expensive. So I think people are likely to play this online exclusively.
But what works really nicely is then you get all those mechanics. I really enjoyed the game Lancer, which I think we talked about previously, where you're really mapping out, okay, do I have a line of sight? If I use this projection, it has a, you know, it will hit him or him. And this is where the shoving mechanic comes into. There's a real focus in this game of force movement, partly because you can literally shove enemies into obstacles and cause damage. But you can also have mechanics to like pull them towards you, deal the damage, and then instead of using your movement, you can then move your movement to move away, out of range. That's all really fun. And then the next feature that I really, really enjoy, because it harkens back to my love of the 2D20 Conan game, is that this game uses a lot of, kind of, I believe the term is metacurrency. It's the gaming term, and I know people can be quite iffy on it. But all your abilities, at least all the abilities that I've used so far, are tied to your character's metacurrency, which is extinguished at the end of a combat encounter, and you earn it throughout the encounter very naturally. Like, at the start of all your turns, you get, here's some currency. And there are other things you can do to earn more, but it sort of gives this sense of you're never running out of your ability to use your cool abilities. You know, it's not like you've got a spell cast and you're gonna run out and then you're sort of just sat there. You're constantly accruing your opportunity to use your coolest abilities. What it means is, though, that you go straight in to at the start of combat and be like, right, here we go, level 8 spell. You're starting from that position of, right, start off slow and you're gonna ramp up as you accrue more of your meta currency. And you get more opportunities to accrue even more metacurrency. And I like that.
That is true.
It gives a sense of escalation rather than diminishing returns.
Because you get to employ more of your cool stuff as the fight goes on. But I will point out one thing, even though we've been talking about this game for a little bit, which is that the one exception to you can't go all out from the start is that the more fights you engage in, you gain things called victory points. And you end up with more of your currency equal to your number of victory points. So if you have done a lot of fights in a row, like 6, you'll start off the fight with a ton of your meta currency to just lash out with your strongest abilities right from the start, which encourages you to not do the classic D&D thing of have one big fight and then go rest, and have one big fight and then go rest, which so many dungeon masters struggle with. How do I make my players want to keep fighting? Well, in Drawsteel, they're rewarded for fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting.
Which I really enjoy. I think I've said this before when I talked about the Conan RPG. In that game, it's called Momentum. I really like having some sort of benefit to not doing a long rest. Like, unless your DM is going to like punish you by using, you know, the real world clock of the game world. For like, you know, you can't have a long rest because in 12 hours the enemy army is going to be here. There's no mechanical way of not wanting to take a long rest. It's always good for you. You know, you replenish everything. I like now having a kind of a mechanic level of, okay, why would we not want to? Fantastic.
The great thing about the Conan RPG, as Duncan was saying, is that the momentum mechanic there was like, if you were fighting well, you literally built momentum. You got extra points for rolling well, and then you could spend your points you got from rolling well to roll more dice to earn more momentum. So there was this sensation of you started off fights kind of on the back foot, and then even as you were getting hurt and more damaged, you were getting more and more powerful, which meant you could end fights quicker. So that was a beautiful aspect of that game, which had its flaws, but that was something that worked. It was so fun.
Do you know what? I have actually nothing else really to talk about to what I've been experiencing. So we'll just drop in. I am watching with eagle eyes. There is a new Conan game being developed. There's been released a quick start, which I believe was last year. And I believe we're meant to get the actual game release sometime in late September.
Nope, got delayed.
Well, so, but that's soon. So watch for space. We're not done talking about sword and sorcery stuff after all. Speaking of...
Ilmet in Lankmar by... How do you... Okay, Geordie, go for it. How do you pronounce this author's name?
Fritz Lieber.
Fritz Lieber.
Yeah, you can thank my love of German musical theatre for that.
So, this is a bit of a weird one. Because this story isn't necessarily... I think I said this up, this is like the first story. This isn't 100% true. This is sort of the first chronological story where these two characters meet and interact. Although there were other stories written about them before this came out. In fact, I think there were other stories where they also met and interact before Ilmek and Lankmere. But this is the first chronological one where they met and interact. I'll be honest, it's almost as complex as the Elric saga. And I am nowhere near the same level of expertise in it.
Okay. I'm pretty confused because, granted, I only did a scan of a Wikipedia page before going into this, so I expected to get a very robust breakdown from Duncan explaining the history, because what I read there was a little bit contradictory, where it said this story is a prequel to already written stories explaining how Fufford and the Grey Mouser meet, and then they're going to go on subsequent adventures, but the page also said... Yeah, and he'd been writing these characters for 30 years. So he'd been writing them since the 40s and only published them in the 70s.
I have really struggled to get my head around this universe. I think the main thing when you're approaching it, though, is despite the very complicated history of this short sword and sorcery fiction being released, remember, a lot of this would have been done in magazines at the time. You know, this is sort of fantasy fiction magazines. I believe the one this was released in was actually called Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. Great name.
That is surprisingly to the point.
But, similar to Elric, it was eventually all collected into actual volumes. And this is pretty much exclusively how it's been packaged since. And these volumes break down with Swords and Devilry, which is where Ilmek and Lankmere appears. And then goes on in pretty much chronological order. All I can say is that I have found evidence that the author is very happy with you reading the collected books in the order that starts chronologically and then gets slightly twisty further down the line.
So a little bit more Elric of Minimine and a little bit less Conan the Barbarian, or even, since we're talking about an author writing this stuff decades before and then later coming back and being like, okay, now I'm going to get it all in working order, almost Tolkien-esque in that way.
I think certainly so, and one of the reasons why I feel when we talk about Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser, why it's a bit more acceptable to kind of approach them in this re-edited chronological way, whereas I don't recommend that with Robert E. Howard's Conan, for example, is the fact that it was re-edited and repackaged by the original creator. And I think that adds a lot to the fact that, no, he sat down, looked at his own work and went, right, I am now going to build myself my preferred chronology for these stories.
So, Duncan, I'm not familiar with Fafhrd and Grey Mouser. I've only heard them spoken about in abstract by other fans of fantasy as an example of classic sword and sorcery, mentioned in the same breath as Elric, Conan, Solomon Kane, characters like that. All I know about them is that they are a dynamic duo. No, that's it. That's literally all I know. I know that Fafhrd's the big one.
So, I first came across these characters, surprise, surprise, by actually reading Marvel's Conan the Barbarian comic book series, where they were parodied, and there was a character called Fafhrd and Black Rat, who have a similar opening scene to what we have in Ilmek and Lankmere, where they come across a downed body, and they're start, but instead of in this story where they kind of team up over splitting the loot, they break out into a fight, and then the character of Conan comes in, bonks them both on the head, and then walks off with the gold. And that was my first introduction.
So some there's some obviously some heated rivalry between Fritz Lieber and the inheritors of the Conan estate. No love lost there.
I think it's a general budding admiration. Fafnir and the Grey Mouse is often held up as this other great cornerstone of the sword and sorcery genre. And kind of why it pains me so much that it's taken me so long to get round to it. Because it's spoken about continuously, like you said, you've got this kind of buddy dynamic duo going through the sword and sorcery stories, which in itself is an interesting kind of selling point. You think about Robbie Howard's work, Solomon Kane, Cole, Conan, quite independent, singular, strong-willed heroes, or anti-heroes, and you want to look at it, protagonists. And even Elric, I know it's framed with the eternal champion being Elric, and Moorcock creates the internal companion, which I just think is the funniest shit. Great slides. Like, you are destined to just be his mate. It's not really the selling
point. I have a lot to say about the eternal champion. You're right, because Elric and Corum can change sidekicks. You know, sometimes their sidekick is their paramour, sometimes it's just one guy who's hanging out with him for a bit. You know, Elric can trade between Jaehaerys Corum and Rakir the Red Archer, Divim Slorm, Moonglum. He can change his sidekicks. But these two, they're not even like a Batman and Robin. They are fire and ice.
They are. This is very much equal billing, these two characters, and it's very much so that these are the guys that are going to play off each other, that are going to become the fastest of friends, and this is the story where they first have their first adventure together. So Geordie, let's get into it. Ilmet and Lankmar. Overall, really quick, what did you think, in a few words?
In a few words? Nice and simple, pretty exciting, promising start, not perfect.
I couldn't agree more. For a very short story, I felt it had some pacing issues, and ultimately there was an issue near the end which I was like, really, you've done that? Okay, let's move
right
on.
Right after we did Gail Simone.
I know, we'll get to it. But how does our story begin? It begins in the city of Lankmar, which is overrun. It is run by the Thief Guild and its subsidiaries, the Beggars Guild. You know, the other little aspects that it manages. And we start on a dark night, following not our main two heroes, but another group of thieves. I believe they're coming back from a heist.
Yes, this is described as a counter-robbery. There's two thieves, Thisif and Sevlus, who have done this, you know, this great caper. And suddenly, not only is it... So, the whole point of this opening scene is, it's not about daring thieves doing a jailbreak. It's about the stacked nature of violence and crime in Lankmar. These two have pulled off their heist. They're running across the rooftops, trying to get back to their hideout. And not only are they ambushed, they're ambushed by two separate individuals simultaneously, because the whole thing we're set up to have is Fufford and the Grey Mouser have the exact same plan. They accidentally jump in and do the plan at the exact same time, and rather than fight over this, they immediately decide, without any words, to team up and do it together.
The kind of golden line is Fufford looking over at the Grey Mouser over the knocked out bodies and just being like, 60-60?
That was great. I loved the 60-60 bit. It's fantastic fantasy writing of doing something just a little bit wrong, like George Orwell saying the clocks were striking 13. 60-60! At that point, I was raising so many implications in my head. I was like, do these guys use a base 12 system? Do they have six fingers on their hands? Or is this literally a joke?
Yes, that is the level it's aimed at. And it is, I think, a really nice kind of attitude of, this isn't the darkest kind of world. These two are going to have a level of kind of lighthearted banter and a playfulness in their relationship. And I think that's established straight off the bat.
The thing that sort of elevates it above this just being the like happenstance of the two of them meeting, this book, this story is full of like a certain degree of sardonic humor. There aren't that many like jokes per se. There's just sort of places where it's just kind of played as funny. And immediately after these two have simultaneously attacked these thieves to rob them, and they're just coming to the agreement of how to split it, then they are immediately attacked by another group of bravos who had the exact same idea. And so they are now counter-thieving the thievery.
And I'll be honest, at this point, I was... I don't want to say I was getting confused, but my head was starting to spin. I was like, okay, wait, what's actually important here? Trying to like piece together the plot. And I feel like what's important here is that you just pick up on how the Grey Mouse and Fafa work together.
This feels a lot like an action movie. This is the point where you're, not only is the audience being shown, oh, this guy can do cool stuff, and this other guy can also do cool stuff. This is where one person demonstrates they're good at guns, and the other person demonstrates they're good at kung fu. In this case, we're getting the what feels like it should be the main hero just flexes all of their power and demonstrates why they're the main character. But now it just gets split up into two people. Fafid's very strong, Grey Mouser is small but very fast.
Not overly complex, but they complement each other. And they kind of pull off this sort of... They counter the counter theft. There's a little bit of kind of dark magic as alluded to. They see this sort of half shadowy creature dash off into the night, literally foreshadowing for future events, and you get a kind of a taste of what the magic could be like for this world. You know, this is some sorcery. This is dark. Sorcery is the dark arts. It's something other. We don't massively approach it, at least not for the moment. And once they succeeded in this, what do they do? Well, they need to get back to their little thievy hideaways. And they decide, let's go together. Let's get drunk together. And let's have a good night. Don't know what else more to add there. That's what happens next. They pick up their two lady friends. Fafnir picks his up from where they were staying. And they go back to the Grey Mouse's hideaway. A little kind of, I don't know, nest box on the side of this pub. They make a big deal, lavish descriptions of this little place that the Grey Mouse is staying in. Sort of, it's run down and it's pokey, but he's tried his best for the sake of his female partner. I believe her name is, there's two, and they both start with V's, and got my head going a bit. Is his partner Vianna?
Vlana. I can see why you think it was Vianna, because the L could look like an I. The other one is Ivrian.
And they go back, and to be honest, we get a really nice description of the Grey Mouse's hidey hole. It's sort of this run down, rotten floorboards, but he's dressed it really nicely. You know, he's burnt some incense, he's put down some rugs, he's trying to make it a really nice place.
Extraordinarily nice, actually. Like, it's literally princely. This was a weird moment in the book. I'm like, oh, these two are both really early in their career, but it seems like the Grey Mouser is outrageously more successful than I would expect, and way more successful than Fufford. Like, he seems like he's got it made. He's minted.
He certainly does, and it's certainly quite interesting how it's not really kind of let out, you know, are they hurting for money? Why have they chosen this sort of thievery as their career path? Is it just what you do in Lankmar? It's something that's very much alluded to in the next sort of section, where we get a little bit of their backstories. Most importantly, though, a shocking revelation. Geordi, this isn't the story of how they first met.
That's right. They stay briefly. They sort of say, like, hey, I think we may have run into each other before. So even though this is, like, the origin story of their partnership, clearly Fritz Lieber was not satisfied with that, and they'd been on some previous pirate adventure or something.
Which, as far as I'm aware, is not chronicalised. I had a brief look in my copy of Swords Against Devilry, and there are two short stories that chronologically come before Ilmek and Lankmar. One is about Fafr's sort of upbringing. He was the son of a sort of ice witch. The short story is called The Snow Women. And the other one, it follows the Grey Mouser as sort of a hedge wizard. The story is called The Unholy Grail.
So even though this is sort of a prequel to the two of them getting together and forming their little group, they still are prequels to sort of do their individual origin stories, like the lead up to an Avengers movie.
Absolutely, but and quite importantly though, neither of those stories cover the first encounter as referenced in this story. So it's sort of that weird little, I don't know how to put it. Do you ever read kind of like Star Wars? What am I talking about? What do you mean, do you ever? I know full well your history with Star Wars Legends books.
You know every single Star Wars book I've read, Duncan, because you've made me read all of them. That's not true. I can't even say that anymore, because I read First Flight.
I've not even read First Flight. Outward Flight. Yeah.
Whatever. Outward Flight?
Outward Bound Flying. I make the comparison because in a lot of those early books, George Lucas was very much like, you cannot depict the actual moment that Han and Chewie, like, form their partnership. You can allude to it, you can do the very immediate up to it, and you can do, like, the aftermath, but that moment is completely off limits, just in case, like, I want to go in and do that moment.
Except this is just, like, Fritz Lieber to himself being like, I feel I have this idea for their first encounter, or I like the idea that their paths have brushed against each other in their, like, great adventures up till this point. But this is the definitive. This is the moment where they're like, okay, we're a group now.
So,
this section of the story, with the two of them genuinely, I can't stress this enough, broing out. Because it really is that. There are no machinations, you know, there's no heist going on. They're not planning their next move. If anything, they are planning how to not do any more next moves. It's just the two of them running each other and are like, hey, I kind of like this guy's vibe. Let's just hang out. Let's get some drinks. When Farford introduces Grey Mouser to Vlana, it legitimately is just like, I want to go hang. I'm going to go get my girl. And then Grey Mouser is like, well, in that case, let's make this a double date. I've got a girl as well.
For me, it was the moment where they, like, run out of wine, and they're both like, okay, we'll leave you ladies here, we're going down the pub to pick up more wine. And then when they're there, they just have a couple of drinks to themselves and chat, and it's just such a natural kind of stepping away from the party, we just want to get to know each other. It really does sell
their friendship. It really does remind me of being at university, you know? When you're at university, you're at a party, you meet someone, and then you just hang out and just hang for a bit and then go on and do a couple of murders together.
Oh, those were the days, weren't they, mate? Now, Geordie, I have to say, this is the bit of the story, though, that I was a little bit alluding to. While this bit is clearly so important to Fritz Lieber in terms of establishing, like, them becoming friends, and I think it's amazing for doing that, and I do believe if you were more familiar with their later adventures, this would be great. This would be like gold dust. You'd be like, oh my goodness, this is how it happened. I can see it. It's so natural. It's so great. Approaching this for the first time, I was just a bit like, so are we going on another adventure? Because I don't even know what the plot of the rest of this story is going to be. Come on, guys.
Genuinely, this felt a little bit like, I don't know, The Hangover? More so than a fantasy adventure, because genuinely, the whole point of this section is, not only are they becoming friends, they are getting more and more drunk. Because a major thing throughout the rest of the story is that all of this takes place in one really long night, and they are pissed the entire time.
Seriously, it comes up when they actually go onto the next bit of the adventure. It's multiple times they bring up the fact that they are completely wasted and not on their best form and just kind of hanging in there. And in fact, what I really enjoy is the fact that there's this real sense of if they weren't so drunk, they wouldn't even be attempting the madness that they do later on. So how do we get there?
The story does keep going, and it all hinges around the ladies. And, you know, you speculated, Duncan, that maybe this story works better if you're already familiar with Farford and Grey Mouser. You're going back to the prequel to see how they met. You're already bought into the relationship. I think this is the one place where the opposite is true. That we are experiencing it in the correct way, because reading this, I have no idea how important Vlana and Yvraine are to the story. Like, are these going to be long-lasting characters who I'm going to get to know a lot? Or are they just here for this one story? Because we spend a lot of time with Vlana and Yvraine learning about, especially Yvraine's backstory, about how she was like a nobleman's daughter, but was very poorly treated by him. And Grey Mouser met her because he rescued her from his dungeons. And it feels like a genuine fairy tale story, which you're just catching the very tail end of. And I really liked the character of Yvraine in particular, because she was so incongruous with the rest of the story. Everyone else in that room with Yvraine is a professional thief. Everyone in that room is a killer, except for her. So she has this really different idea about the world. She knows that she's at the end of a fairy tale, and that's how she thinks the world works. She doesn't realise what kind of story she's in.
I'll be honest with you, Jordy, you've put that in such a more sophisticated fashion than I was picking up when I was reading. I was like, yeah, okay, is this just alluding to like another off-page adventure? What is this? Why are we here? And I actually walked away originally with quite a negative outlook. I was like, oh, this is just quite a long-winded way to set up the motivation for the next leg of this story. I prefer how you said it, though. Actually, that is kind of fun. I see what Lieber may be playing with here.
Ultimately, I think your point is true. These two women are placed in the story as the love interests of the two main male heroes in order to die, to then be avenged.
Whoa.
They're going to be fridged. That's why they're here.
Spoilers, but yes. They are here to provide motive, like they're the motivating factor. They're the reason why our heroes go out. They're not immediately fridged, I should highlight in this story. It starts out, Yvraine is basically says, I know the man that screwed me. No, not Yvraine. Vlana. Vlana? Vlana. Who's like, I was screwed over Vlana by the head of the Thieves Guild. He doesn't like me and wasn't nice to the band I was running with at the time. You two should go and bring me his head.
I had some interesting thoughts about the way in which this is sort of presented, and I had complicated feelings about it, because on one hand, the bloodthirsty woman setting a man to do her dirty work is kind of a misogynistic caricature. You know, a great example of it being done would be something like Lady Macbeth, where that's an amazing character, but it's also a certain archetype, which is sort of woman as cold-blooded manipulator. Think very noirish, a lot of femme fatales fill in that role. Vlana, in that way, is a bit of a femme fatale. There are noirish aspects to this story with the seedy underbelly of an urban setting. The other things about it that I kind of like, though, is I kind of appreciate that Vlana is obviously very clever in the way she does this manipulation. Both Farford and the Grey Mouser know their buttons are being pushed. They're well aware that they have a discussion between them of like, what she wants is ridiculous. There's no way we can do it. It would be tantamount to declaring war on a nation as two guys. No, we can't do that. Absolutely, bro. There's no way we can do this. It's completely unreasonable. By the time they get back to the flat, Vlana has gone full attack mode on Yvraine and has completely played into her fantastical fantasies, where she believes the Grey Mouser is like a gentleman thief, like you know, Lupin, or like it's a chivalric knight. And so she's so outraged on Vlana's behalf when they get back that they didn't kill every member of the Thieves Guild they could get their hands on before. And they must go out and do it right now, or she'll be very cross with them.
And the Grey Mouser clearly disguised an idea of, you know, if you want a happy life, keep the person in your life happy. So he caves very quickly at this point.
This is sort of what I was talking about with a sort of like, this isn't a story that's full of jokes, but it is kind of funny. Because you're experiencing this sudden rapid change from Fafhrd and Grey Mouser leave. They have a talk about how unrealistic and ridiculous this idea of declaring war in a Thieves Guild is, about how it's suicide. They walk back in, they're immediately ambushed, and then Grey Mouser immediately, to save face, changes his mind. And that's the other thing I liked about this. I liked the fact that they're sort of shoehorned into this purely by their own pride. No one's actually making them do this. At the end of the day, if they really wanted to, they could stand up and say, Vlana, you really need to be realistic about this. We can't do it. But it's their bravado, and it's their unwillingness to admit that, no, we can't do this, that leads them to sort of take the first step down the road and leads to this slow avalanche.
And then we get into the really good bit of the story. They have been talked into this. They're like, fine, let's head out. There's a really nice little moment. I actually like it. They leave and we actually stay with Yvraine and Vlana because they're waiting. There's like a creaky stairs up to this little thief's den they're staying in, and they're waiting to hear the creak of the stairs. And they never hear it because the lads basically take off over the rooftops. Enjoyed it. Lovely way to like, it's not just cool that they like took off, it's the fact that we don't see them do it. We sit with a different character. It's like the Batman disappearing. It only works because the camera's on Jim Gordon and he just turns back round.
And to a certain extent, that's a lot of the way in which Fritz creates a sense of fantasy, a sense of wonder in this story. It's not by saying things, it's by talking around things. You know, he presents this city that's full of crime, but much like someone like Robert E. Howard, and to a certain extent, Tolkien, he will just say a name. Or just say a proper noun. Oh, the high priests of such and such, the far distant lands of this, and he will not explain it. He gestures towards the strange, the eerie, the fantastical, and then he quickly moves away. Action is often merely suggested. There isn't really a great breakdown of the detail about fights. When there's a big chase later, we focused purely on Fafhrd and Grey Mouser running across the rooftops. There's no description of the pursuit. We just see these bare flashes of how intense the pursuit is because they can't look back. If they look back, they'll die.
So, these two, the plan is simple, really. The Thief Guild, the shadowy organisation that effectively runs the nation, has a head of the guild, and they're going to take the head off that man and present it to their ladies. Easy plan. What could go wrong?
I will say this. What I appreciate about the rest of the story is that there isn't a plan. They both go out there to do this thing and also to not do it. The two of them really have no modus operandi whatsoever. At a certain point, they're like, let's just break into the Thieves Guild. And when Fafhrd says, how are you going to do that? Grey Mouser's like, I hadn't decided yet, but I just came up with an amazing idea. And when they're halfway through executing this amazing idea, they say, you know what? We're not going to kill him tonight. We're just having a look. We're just poking our noses in. That's what I mention about the fact that they are completely stoned throughout the story really makes it work, because there is just slow car crash. Where on one hand, you're like, everything seems to be going okay. Weirdly okay. When is it all going to go wrong?
for me, this is the feeling of any attempt at genuine self in D&D. You're like, we are one
absolutely
bad roll away from this going wrong. We have managed, we got nat 20s through the front door. You know, and we did some role play. We dressed ourselves up as beggars. Love the detail on how they did that, by the way. But it's like, hey, we got advantage on that roll.
I agree.
And you're just like, when will we fuck up? Because we're going to fuck up. How far can we get before it happens?
The comparison to a party breaking into somewhere in D&D is very apt. And I was thinking it myself, Duncan, but there's one thing which I think you might have on the wrong thing, which is that I don't think it's that the characters are rolling high. It's that the Dungeon Master knows what an atrocious idea this is and is just letting them get into more trouble. He's not even asking them to lie to the guards because he knows the deeper into the Thieves Guild they manage to sneak, the worse it's going to be for them.
I think it speaks a lot that I am majority a player and Geordie's majority always the DM, that we have those two different interpretations. I can only credit it to our brilliance, where he's the DM that just sits there and goes, go on, try it.
Yeah, that's definitely the reason. It's your amazingness.
But we actually get a really nice section here. We get a good detail of the Grey Mouser kind of coming up the fly of these kind of beggar costumes. We get that lightest touch of kind of world building. There's like a beggar's guild, which is like a subsection of the Thieves Guild. And lots of little things just kind of get thrown out there. Like there's a day master and a night master of the Beggars Guild.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, cool. So it's an organization that like they all feed into like one bloke. It's like the day watch and night watch. Okay. They take shifts. Cool. How does this kind of work? And you just kind of, it's enough information for you to extrapolate without bogging down this short story in any real way.
Exactly. There's some great bits later where they're walking around and Farford says like, but no one's going to really believe that you're blind. And they says, well, they don't have to believe I'm blind because none of the beggars of the city are blind.
There's this great bit when they get past the door guards and one of the guards like shouts at us like, guys, you don't need to pretend to be crippled anymore.
It's like, oh, we're just practicing. After that,
they're in the Thieves Guild. This is actually really fun. As they walk through this establishment, they keep kind of like sticking their heads in different doors and you see like different lessons going off.
Yeah, it's Assassin School. Like, we are poking our nose into the start of a YA adventure story about a special boy going to special school to become an assassin. There's like thievery class, there's wizard class. There's like a cluster of like an actual classroom of like 10-year-old thieves learning their trade. And there's even a bit where they're like, hey, we should stick around a bit because we could learn a lot about being better thieves if we listened in.
But eventually they do push through and they sneak their way up into the next floor of the Thieves Guild. And things kick up a gear because we kind of get introduced to our main villain of the piece. We come across the warlock that is being hired by the Thieves Guild for reasons. And this is alluded to earlier.
Christo Milo.
Names. It's quite a lot. But essentially, in terms of their like sticking their nose in, they stick their nose in a room. And we get this scene of this guy. He has this like rat monkey familiar creature who they spotted earlier. And he's giving out these orders. And it's all out of context. And we don't really know what's going on. What I really kind of find fun here is the fact that the guys basically just go, we're going to back away from this room. They watch some funky spells and they're like, yeah, no, let's go somewhere else.
That's right. They have good instincts of sword and sorcery characters. Like, oh, dark magic. That's not the worth the trouble of dealing with. And again, that feels like a good D&D adventure. You know, they're presented with stuff they don't understand, they back away, and then the dungeon master smirks behind his hand and then just keeps tracking stuff that's going on in the background. The players didn't engage with it, but it doesn't mean it's not going to hurt them.
They do eventually get caught, however, and they are brought before the head of the Thieves Guild, who is, you know, very simply put, who are you? What are you doing? Should I just have you killed? And then the Grey Mouser makes himself as a character.
I love this bit.
Love this scene.
It's so amazing.
This is, if you've ever kind of read a character who's meant to have the gift of the gab and he can spin a tale, you ain't read nothing, mate. This was amazing. This also reminds me of a guy just reading it off in D&D, because this is a scene of a character going from lie to lie to lie and escalating it and coming up with just random, completely out of the way factors to keep this going and keep himself alive.
It's incredible. It's full on Better Call Saul stuff. He like sticks to the lie to begin with. The moment they start to be caught in doubt, he just escalates until he's saying, "I'm here to undermine a conspiracy against you, Krovus, the head of the Thieves Guild, because there are these great powers who are amassing against you, and you know, and they're being represented by all the seven most powerful figures of the world." And the great thing about this is that Farfad, like, kind of tries to jump in and help and tells this, like, ridiculous lie. And the Grey Mouser improvises and he rolls with it straight away. And there could not be a better way of showing, not telling, how smart this character is whilst having it be utterly unsuccessful. This is a genius character who cannot talk his way out of the impossible situation he's put himself in, but good God, is he gonna try.
You hit on the head. Like we mentioned earlier, the idea that they reference very offhandedly that there's like a night master of the beggars and a day master, and they're like, bring in the night master, he'll tell us that they're real beggars. And they go, oh, no, you don't understand. We were part of the Day Watch. He wouldn't recognise us. And the guy's just there like, the head of the Day Watch has been ill for 10 days. I've been doing both. And they're like, what do we do? And you're right, he goes on. I love the fact.
Well,
the Seven, he just makes up this conspiracy. It's like, yeah, there's a characters and courts and all this evil going on. You're like, is this actually part of the plot?
The King of Kings is rallying against you, sire. It's a great, and I want to say one more thing, which is that there is no dithering and dovering once the lie is called out, because the exact moment there is no way out of a lie, it is pure attack mode. There isn't a second of hesitation. The Grey Mouser instantly just explodes out and goes for the kill.
Obviously, this scene ends with them being absolutely caught. But what's really kind of interesting in this is that they kind of make it clear that the guards that are holding them are basically getting so bewildered, they're no longer sure, like, are we arresting them? Are we killing them? What are we releasing them? And it touches in throughout the Grey Mouse's spiel that the guards are like getting, like, they're like, am I holding him tighter? Is my boss with, like, their confusion is constantly touched upon. So that when the Grey Mouse is at the final moment where he's like, right, we're rumbled, and dives forwards, the guard's completely unprepared. And you know he's unprepared because he's had this like, hold him tighter, no, loosen, tighter, loosen, throughout the entire spiel.
What I also like about this subsequent scene is that, again, I brought it up several times, the thing that really works about this is that you're watching two guys who are kind of at the top of their game, having their worst day ever. Because as clever as they are, and as strong as they are, and as competent as they are so drunk. So he does this, he rattles off this lethal spiel, which should save the day. He gets called out, he immediately bursts into a fight, and gets tripped up over his own feet, hits the deck. They realize they cannot win, and they just book it. They just run away as fast as they can.
There's so many like small moments in this that I love. I just want to hit on three. One is that when he hits the deck, there's like this bit where he's like, he tried to turn a bad fool into a good fool.
Which had already been set up earlier in the story where he's trying to tell them, I'm not drunk. I can totally go and kill Krovus, the Marshal of the Thieves Guild. See, watch me walk in a straight line. Trips over his own feet, but then does a dramatic front flip, rights himself, does a little bow, and then trips over himself again and falls over.
Something that's set up throughout the whole of this section is that to pretend to be crippled, Fafir has had one of his legs, like, tied behind his back. So what the Grey Mouser does. He takes his dagger and dives towards Fafir and goes, "Don't worry, guys. I'll slit his tendon." And then what he's actually, everyone's like, "Oh, is he on our side?" And then what he's going straight in to undo the rope holding Fafnir's leg back. And I really enjoy the fact that Grey Mouser is like, "Brilliant, you're on your feet, let's go." And then Fafir is still like hopping. He's like, "No, my leg's gone dead. I still can't do anything."
That was genuinely the thing that it was like, probably the closest thing to a joke in this thing. But it's just great, the fact that everything about this heist has gone so badly wrong. It feels like something out of like a Hangover movie almost. I know you said you're going to say two more things you liked about this chase, but I will add one more thing, which is that I liked that they don't get into any fights after they start running. Because every time they run into a guard, the guard draws their sword when they see the Grey Mouser, then they see Fufford coming up behind, and then they leave. Not only is it two against one, that dude's too big. I'm gonna go. And I thought it really worked to tell the story of this place. They're not fighting like loyal knights, they're fighting thieves. They don't care if it, you know, the guys are escaping. They're not running off of the loot. It's not worth their neck to just die for the job. They just leave. This happens twice in a row.
Just so you know, that was one of my two. The next one is just this beautiful little scene.
There we go.
Where Grey Mouser up a ladder onto the rooftop, Fafir comes up after him. The guy who sees them sees Fafir and buggers off. And then Fafir grabs the ladder and pulls it up. And Grey Mouser's like, "What are you planning to do with that?" And Fafir's just like, "I don't know." And then just throws it over the side of the building.
Exactly. It's so amazing. It could not be a simultaneous version of, "These guys are amazing, but super drunk and kind of stupid right now." But he is full on just like grabbing at whatever he thinks he needs. That feels like something the 8th intelligence barbarian would do at a D&D table, and everyone would have a good laugh over
it. I think genuinely, when that first happened, my brain was like, has he pulled it up behind him so people can't get up the ladder? Are they going to use it to like bridge the gap between buildings? And I just love the fact that like those are two completely legitimate plans. But in that moment, the Grey Mouse is like, "What are you doing?" Fafir can't articulate anything. It's just like, and just throws it out, just kind of lobs it over his shoulder.
I'm sure the other thing you like about it is that the escape itself is really beautiful, because it just really paints this vivid picture of, you know, a sort of Dickensian apocalyptic landscape where they're running through it's either a forest or a jungle of soot-stained chimney pots.
No, I adored this. It did remind me a little bit of the Chin Chimney song in Mary Poppins, not gonna lie. That did pop into my head. But other than that... No, Step in Time, that's the one.
So. They make a break for it. They get away. And, of course, at this point in the story, you're realizing that there isn't a lot of time left. So what happens next feels kind of predictable, but it does have the effective layer of dread built up behind it.
As our characters are running away, there is this smog of darkness that envelops them for a short while and then passes. And their kind of tension is like, "What was that? What just happened?" And they're like, "Oh, don't know. Too much is going on. Let's just get back to the hideaway and see how the girls are doing." And that's when we get to the issue. Geordie.
So it's very appropriate that, Duncan, you chose to follow Gail Simone's take on Red Sonja up with this one. Because these are very contrasting pieces. This story really is everything that story isn't, in both good ways and bad ways. This story is short, it's very fast, it's classic sword and sorcery, but it's also very masculine. You know, there's a lot of, like, id energy going on. It's literally about two lads going to the pub and getting pissed. But also, it's very appropriate that it's Gail Simone in particular, because I would argue Gail Simone's biggest contribution to popular culture is she's of a woman who invented a phrase, which we have said on the podcast many times. She coined the phrase, the woman in the refrigerator. She did it when she commented on a issue of Green Lantern, specifically Kyle Rayner, where a villain murdered his girlfriend, chopped her up into pieces, and stuffed her into the refrigerator. Purely because they had to motivate Green Lantern. Green Lantern had to take down this bad guy. He had to be mad. So they had to introduce, set up, and then murder a woman to do it. That is her purpose in the story.
And this is said in a kind of very kind of negative critique, because what this is doing is that it's taking away any sense of the female character. Being a character, being someone with agency and their own perspective in the plot, they exist purely as an object to motivate our hero, and no time is given to their experience. You can have a character be killed by the villain, you can have a female character be killed by the villain and that motivate the hero and it not be fridging. Yeah, that is possible.
Because Gail Simone did that.
You're absolutely right. And what you do to make it not that...
But that character was a character.
Exactly. You give them an actual character. You give them agency outside the function. And you actually focus on their own experience and their own kind of suffering and loss. Give that to them. You give them basically the respect you would have given if you were killing off the hero. Even if ultimately the end result is they sadly die, and this leads the hero onwards to their quest. It's just what your intentions are and how the work you put into it.
More than that, I would say that this has a sort of like additional sting to it, which is that Vlana is the one who evokes this doom upon herself. She's punished by the narrative for her hubris. It's not really the lads who are being like challenged here. In a sense they are, because they did accept the quest, but it's all Vlana's idea. Vlana's the one who pressures him to do it, and Vlana's the one who pays the cost. I guess Ivana as well. Ivrain as well. But there is something sort of like dark and I was going to say like sadistic about it, being like, well, you kind of had it coming, didn't you? You poked the bear, and now you're reaping the consequence.
So what happens is, the scene that we saw earlier from Fafir and Grey Mouse's perspective of the warlock, that was the scene of him casting the spell and giving the orders to his like familiar minions to go out and murder Vlana and Ivrain. I wasn't 100% clear on the narrative around this point, because this clearly wasn't as a response to them attempting to kill the head of the Thieves Guild, because that wasn't known. Was this simply as an extension
obviously,
of Vlana's prior issues with the Thieves Guild, or as an extension of...
It's about
Fafnir and the Grey Mouser, their theft at the very beginning.
It's about the jewels. It's not even about them. It's purely about the jewels. That is a thing which the story reinforces at the very end, when that's the only thing Fufford and the Grey Mouser take after they attack the Thieves Guild at the end. They only retrieve the jewels. That's the only thing they recover.
So basically,
the rat thing familiars get sent to kill the thieves and return the stolen property. Vlana's personal vendetta against the Thieves Guild is irrelevant, except for the fact that it means that Fufford and the Grey Mouser aren't there. If Fufford and the Grey Mouser had hung out in the hangout there and just chilled out, maybe had gone to bed, had a nap, and had been there when the rat things arrived, no one would have died, because they could very easily have dispatched them.
Now, okay, well, that I'm not going to lie, that's actually lowered the situation a little bit in my mind. At least I thought it was due to her own actions in the world. So it now sucks a little bit more.
It's due to her delusions. Her bad idea is what brings this on. That's why I feel that it's sort of punishing her specifically. and not the male characters, because the only thing they're guilty of is being persuaded by her. It's not their greed that forces them to do this, it's their unwillingness to tell her to shut up.
See, I think it's a slightly different way. I interpret this, based on this prior conversation as well, that because Valana didn't tell Fafhir to go and steal those jewels. At least that's not how I remembered it.
I guess that's true.
So,
but
from a plot standpoint,
I mean,
I would say it robs her of any more agency. It's no response to her actions or anything that she's done. It's simply because she was there, and now the Fafhir and Grey Mouser have a motivation. I think it belittles the character further to kind of take that approach. It's not even punishment, it's just a callous sideswipe.
So, on one hand, there's definitely the aspect of both. The whole point of the story is that crime in the city is organized, and Farford and the Grey Mouser are both bold and hubristic enough to be like, well, I'm gonna be a scab, you know? There's a union of thieves, and I'm going to go behind their back and do unsanctioned thievery. I'm actually gonna steal from the union, and this is where they're gonna pay for that. This is their lesson. They've bitten the hand of a mighty beast, and now they're paying the consequences. The reason why I singled out Vlana's motivation is that is the exact knock-on. Nothing bad would have happened if they had been there. Obviously, they invoke the attack, but if they'd been around, there wouldn't have been a consequence.
No, I think that's actually a very good point to be made. And this was kind of upsetting in multiple ways, because the story had just come off a really good section, and I kind of went, oh, I can no longer full-heartedly recommend this the way I was going to a page ago. Now I have to put a caveat in there. Now I have to have a little think. And I don't think it was needed. I think there are other ways this could have played out in terms of the motivations further on. I could throw a thing of the times, but I don't think that really holds water.
I mean, who cares about things of the times? Like, there's never been a time in history where this hasn't been an aspect of the story. Like, some of the oldest stories in the world start with the violation of women is the instigating factor. And today, you have people, you know, Gail Simone didn't make it illegal to tell this story. This happens all the time. I'll say one more thing on this front, which is that the death of Vlana and Yvrain is deliberately disgusting and brutal. They aren't merely killed. They are. There's a vivid description of how contorted their faces are after being strangled to death, and then subsequently they've been eaten.
Yeah, it's not nice. I have to say that when we have this scene when Fafhir and the Grey Mouser are approaching the hideaway den, there is a certain amount of writing in terms of the gloominess and the darkness, and when you've left this place, when it's kind of like this warm party vibe, the way it's kind of redressed this room to have the stove knocked over and the small lights of the embers still burning, like, this is a dark and creepy vibe. Like, in terms of just an expression of descriptive writing, it worked very well. It was chilling and unpleasant, which was the intention.
Yeah, there's a horrifying aspect to a scene that's supposed to be horrifying. I definitely agree with that. The one thing I don't think you can say about Lieber is clearly, you know, his methodology is good. It's simply the content which we have an issue with so far. Moving on to the climax, which is over with surprising haste, in a way that I feel is quite deliberate. From this point in the story, the moment they arrive back at the house, he makes a very deliberate choice that that Grey Mouser and Fafhir stop speaking to each other. They exchange one line throughout the rest of the story after discovering this grisly scene. And it's purely functional. From this moment on, they are in absolute lockstep. This whole story has been about these are two guys who like each other, they discover they work really well together, and they enjoy each other's company. And in the final section, they are so in sync. They are so lined up and locked in together, no words need to be exchanged. No words are exchanged. They are full on the track, and they know what they have to do.
So what we now get is actually quite an interesting repeat of the previous stealth mission, because now they ain't going stealthy, but they actually take the exact same route. And I thought this was very kind of quite actually an enjoyable method to this. We get the Grey Mouser setting up this kind of burning sack of oil and embers, and effectively they stroll up to the front gate, their swords are at the ready, and he just lobs this homemade incendiary grenade into the guard's hidey hole. It erupts, fire goes up everywhere, and then they storm in the door.
There's a clinical approach to the brutality here. There is no mention of emotion. There's no mention of thoughts in their head. The writing becomes extremely prescriptive. You know, if this was a Conan story, how would we be describing the tempestuous barbarian rage, the great high temper that he was in? And the story here is just, they did this, they did that, they did this, Grey Mouser threw the thing. And this, it could not be more illustrated in a moment that genuinely made me go, whoa, out loud, and repeat it just in case I'd misheard, which is that they storm in past one of the classrooms which they had poked their head into earlier. And they're in there, the like thieves in training are like start to run. And one of these people, who is described as a 10-year-old kid, doesn't attack, just doesn't get out of the way fast enough, and Fufford stabs him and kills him.
This was a really kind of shocking moment. Now, there's a conversation earlier in the story where Fafir has a conversation with the Grey Mouser. I keep calling him the Grey Mouser. It doesn't feel right to shorten it to Mouser or Grey. It is the Grey Mouser.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Grey Mouser talks about murdering. And Fafir has this whole thing about, it's not murdering when it's fighting. And the Grey Mouser goes, that's just another name for it. You know, killing is murder, as eating is gorging and drinking is guzzling. You know, you can give it a nicer name, but murder is murder. So you already got this slight kind of moral aspect in your head and what they both think about the act of killing. So when you have Fafir, who's sort of said, well, you know, if it's in a fight, you're in battle, it's just what you have to do. To have him do this kind of cold kill is very shocking, because he's a likable protagonist, and this really makes you go, mm-hmm. Oh, okay, what are you capable of?
Yeah, and this comes down to, I've said this a couple of times, but it really needs to be reiterated. This short story really could be a masterclass in show, don't tell. Because there doesn't need to be a moment where we revisit that discussion of how Fufford justifies killing. There doesn't need to be a moment in that exact second where he feels conflicted. It doesn't need to justify why he does this. The fact that the story shows it happens, and that it immediately moves on, it tells you everything you need to know about the character's mindset. The way in which the story is told, you know, it's like, how is it? The method is the meaning. That's it. It's done. There's a bit later where, ever so briefly, once the fighting is done, he's like, oh, I did that. And he has to reckon with it. But there's no conclusion that it's come to. There's no justification. It's just the note that now that the heat of battle is done, Fufford registers what he's done. And that's all you get to know. And that's interesting.
And this is actually built off, I feel, a little bit later. So as they storm up to the next floor, they've noticed that all the rooms have been barred. The wizard, the warlock, is chanting away. I love the fact that all the other kind of Thieves Guild members have cleared out. They're like, okay, the wizard's on our side, but we are not getting between the big sword-wielding barbarian and the wizard. We do not want to be part of this.
And what happens is, again, going back to core fantasy stuff, dark magic is being thrown at them. And the thing that overcomes dark magic is just bullheadedness. It's not a question of outsmarting them. It's not a question of summoning up greater magical power. The Grey Mouser used to be a wizard's apprentice, and he says the one thing he learned is not to mess with dark magics. But they are so focused, they're so locked in, they're so determined to see it done, they just don't care. They're slashing through dark webs, a demon spider gets summoned, and they just cut it down without a second thought. Again, method is meaning.
And then we get this final moment when they're facing off against the sorcerer. Now, Fafir has already gone to throw a weapon, and it's like being slowed down by these dark webs, these kind of tendrils in the air. And so as he's kind of being pushed back, he reaches for a silver dagger that I believe this is Valana's dagger, and he whips it round and he throws it at the sorcerer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think we're given any real detail that this is how magic works. We just see it being borne out. The silver dagger cuts through the magic, strikes the warlock in the eye, and he falls down dead. Like, the job is done.
Very Howard. There's the conclusion of Black Colossus, which is probably probably one of the best Conan stories, is Conan has to fight a giant snake. The dude is about to stab... God, who is it in that story? Not Olivia. Duncan, you should know.
Yes, it's Queen Ismild.
I was about to say Yashana, but I figured out from the previous episode who Yashana is. She's from Elric, not from Conan.
One sec. I will remember this.
It's a race. I'm looking now.
Yasmila.
Well done. I opened it up to the exact right page, just picking up my book. Ysmelda, that's right. He's about to stab Ysmelda, and Conan just throws his sword across the room. It plunges into the guy's heart, and guess what happens when you throw a sword into a guy's heart? He dies. It doesn't matter that he's a wizard. That's it.
Now, why I also think it's really kind of interesting to note in this scene, that Fafir gets the kill on the warlock, whereas the Grey Mouser goes to finish off his rat monkey familiar creature.
Mm.
And I think it's kind of just worth noting that the Grey Mouser still hasn't killed a person.
Hmm. That is interesting. He didn't... No, he killed someone in the opening fight.
Did he?
He killed two people, actually.
Okay.
Fafir killed one, and
I take it all back.
Grey Mouser killed
two. Really strong point.
Just to flex.
Well, forget my valid point I'd written notes on about he was the one challenging the murdering point and this moral dynamic between the two characters. Throw that note in the bin.
I mean, I will point out, literally, just to flex, he even says, like, I killed that second guy, even though I knew you had him, just to show you how fast I am.
Listen, mate, it's a long story. I sometimes forget the beginnings.
But the funny thing is...
And that's it.
That's it. They take two mementos that belong to their girls, one each, which just so happened to contain the jewels this whole thing was over, and then they leave Lankmar.
They do. We get a very kind of quick closing. There is not any dialogue between our two leads. We simply hear how they kind of drop out the building. Let me see. I'm going to read a bit, and maybe we'll lose this in the edit if it's over long. But the way this story ends, there's just the kind of descriptive narration of this city sort of just about to wake up. Like, the dawn's just about to come. We've had this wild and crazy night. And then, in the dim pink light beginning to seep from the east, although there were many forms asleep, a snore, a dream in the gutter, and under the dark porticoes. Yes, turning right and east down the Street of Gods, for that way was the Marsh Gate, leading to Causey Road, across the Great Salt Marsh, and the Marsh Gate was the nearest way out of the great and glamorous city that was now loathsome to them.
Mm.
Indeed, not to be endured for one more stabbing, laden heartbeat than was necessary. A city of beloved, unfaceable ghosts.
So good.
A star.
Yeah, that's a fantastic ending to it. Like, really wrap up the sort of the elemental nature of fantasy, where The things that reside in a character's heart paint the entire world. The city was full of splendor and intrigue and adventure, and now it is soiled forever. It is this dark mark which they have to leave by the most expeditious route possible because they can't stand to be in it for a moment longer.
I love how Fritz Lieber writes. I did not love everything he wrote.
Yep.
But he certainly can bloody well write.
Quick, punchy, beautifully described. That is what classic sword and sorcery is all about. Often with some unpleasantness tied in. And to be frank, we're speaking as we've mentioned Moorcock, we've mentioned Conan. This is not as unpleasant as stuff that's in some of those stories. Even Moorcock, who's writing at the exact same time as Lieber, you know, this story has a guild of beggars. Moorcock wrote about an entire city of beggars and just goes on and on about how much he hates homeless people.
Geordie, I feel like we've been incredibly harsh on this book for things that other authors have done and we've not been nearly as harsh for. Thinking about Dreaming City and the death of Elric's love interest in that story, who has not a tenth of the characterisation that the Vlana and Evrain have in this book. And we kind of, I think, a bit more skip over it. I feel, to be honest, because we came with Gail Simone, I feel like it's more at the forefront of my mind. And also, in many respects, it's because this story was doing so perfectly well otherwise. Just so perfectly well, apart from that one moment.
Yeah, this is not the most offensive version of this we've seen, not even close in our history of doing the podcast. You know, there's no sexual violence in the story whatsoever. It's not clear why Vlana is so set against the Thieves Guild master. Yeah, there's, to a certain extent, you could say the loss of a character like Evrain, it does serve a sort of thematic quality to it. You know, she is a character who, despite having a hard past, lived in a world of innocence, and that innocence is shattered by her death. You know, there is a sort of a point being made there that goes beyond motivating Grey Mouser and Fofid. A character like Cimmeril lives to die. She exists to be Elric's ghost. She serves no other purpose.
So, coming to the end, Geordie, I suppose we've just got to ask ourselves, do we recommend this story? Should people read it? Do we want to keep reading it? How do you kind of contextualise, and how are you going to talk about Ilmet and Lankmar going forward?
I think it's a good story. I'm very intrigued about where the story goes next. I'm especially intrigued from a sort of perspective of canonicity. You know, is this a good place to start the story at the beginning? Because often that's not the case. I think the best way to start the Elric saga is not with Elric of Minibene, but with the Dreaming City, which is like the fourth to last story.
Depending on what chronology you follow, sometimes it's like the 11th to last story. But again, that's a different kettle of fish. I thought that Ilmek and Lankmar, I really struggled, I'm going to be honest with you, to read the opening sections of this book. Up until they head out for the Thieves Guild, I genuinely was like, gosh, have I picked another dud? Is this going to work for me? And then it kicks up into such a gear. When it is good, it is so blindingly good. It reminds me why I love this subgenre and why I've kept us on it for three kind of episodes straight. Because I adore the dark sorcery. I adore the ingenuity of the fight. I enjoy the relatively low stakes and the fast pace and the short story format so much. This is good sword and sorcery. And yeah, while it has its instance of fridging, I want people to be aware of it, like when you're approaching this story. And it's certainly a marker down, but I think a lot of my things I have to say is against the practice in general, not necessarily damning this story for inventing it or doing it worse. because I've seen it done so much worse in other stories that I like. But I think, you know, as an audience and as a, you know, you deserve to hear about it. And as a reviewer, I need to critique it. But for me, there is still so much going on that I'm like, well, I need to read more of these stories, because could just be through the natural act of telling a different plot, that black mark won't be against the next Fafnir and Grey Mouser. I presume so. If it's in all of them, I will have a much larger critique. But I'm going to assume he doesn't do this every time. And so I'm very excited to read more.
I actually rather assumed, I'm excited to read more too, and I actually assumed that part of the reason why both of them have a girlfriend and both of them get killed is that I think it's likely that maybe they both don't have a lot of paramours. Because in a typical sword and sorcery, you'd have the hero defeat the bad guy and then get the girl, right? Well, if there's two heroes, then they're, unless they're all, you know, all coupling up together, a la Red Sonja, well, then you're kind of going to have to pick a favorite each time, aren't you? And then one of them will be having a big romantic scene at the end, and the other one will be twiddling their thumbs. Or, like Moonglum, pretending not to listen to Elric have sex with Zarazin.
Do you think this could be more of a case? Because this story, as we sort of established at the start, you know, was written after many of the others. Could this be a kind of a retroactive action of being like, no, they're not gay. Look, they're with two women. They're just not in any more stories.
Maybe. There you go.
Is that more where this is coming from?
I literally cannot say, but it did cross my mind.
I suppose the only way to find out would be, well, to be honest, even if we read all of them, we may never know truly the workings of the author's mind, but that would be the road to take.
Well, Duncan, thank you for sharing that. I enjoyed myself. It didn't take me long to read, and also, I didn't have to pay for it. I got it for free, so hey-ho. Great win for Geordie.
Geordie, can you just expand on that? Where did you get it for free?
They're just giving it away on Audible for free.
Nice.
Because it's a short story. I could have bought Swords and Deviltry, but I didn't, because I just had to get this one. And I've had Swords and Deviltry on my wish list for ages, because you told me 3 years ago you wanted to do that book.
No, very true. And given that it's free on Audible, would you recommend it to anyone? For it being free?
If it's free. It's three and it's 2 hours and 20 minutes long. I definitely recommend it, even if you have issues with fridging. Not the most offensive version I've ever seen. Speaking of getting books for free, Duncan, have you managed to get your hands on the book I told you to read 2 weeks ago?
So I ordered the next book from my library and I went to pick it up last week. I went, really sorry, it was in the reserve section with your name on it. It appears someone has taken it. We'll order you in another one. And I went back today and Geordie, I got told we're really sorry, but it appears that they're all either on loan and the one we thought we were going to get for you, the person didn't return on time, so we're presuming missing. And I went, that's okay, thank you for doing your job. I've got to go and give more money to Jeff Bezos. So, I've got the book now.
Hooray! Truly a victory for the forces of justice. And Duncan, at long last, because I finished this book already. I told you this on Monday, and you're like, I still don't have it. But I've picked it, and I gotta say, I really liked it.
Spoilers, but that's really good to hear. I've actually was worrying recently that we're having a bit of a negative year. You know, not that they've always been bad books, but we've not had our minds blown for a while. I would genuinely say it's not been since we did Black Company that I was like, this is some good stuff. Oh, wait, no, did we do Watership Down?
And I was going to say, Duncan, I was thinking the same thing, and I was going to start off the next episode by saying exactly that, because this is the first book in a long time where I've gone, that was so good, I'm really glad I read it.
Well, cannot wait. Have you said the name of it yet?
I have not, Duncan, as you well know, but our listeners do not, the next book we're going to read is a real change of pace from the last three sword and sorcery works, and indeed for pretty much everything else we've done this year since, I don't know, Legends and Lattes? We are going to be reading Paladin's Grace by T. Kingfisher.
I am so very, very excited. I mean, you've already praised
it. I did not know anything about this book when I picked it. It is a romance. It is, like, softer and less intense than the other ones we've read recently, even though there are a lot of beheadings in it. But rock solid, great dynamic in a relationship. I can't wait to discuss it with you, Duncan, once you've actually got your... Once you've cracked it open, you've read it through.
I cannot wait till then. In the meantime, if you've been listening to this episode and you have your own opinions on the wider series, perhaps you've read all of Fafnir and the Grey Mouser, let us know. The best place, as always, is It's Just Fantasy Podcast on Instagram, or our Gmail, itsjustfantasypodcast@gmail.com, or you can catch us on Blue Sky at Just Fantasy. I cannot wait to hear people's thoughts, and also hear thoughts on anything else that we talk about. If you're a fan of Paladin's Grace, tell us. If you've played Draw Steel,
there are a lot of fans of Paladin's Grace,
then tell us what you think of the game. If you just like listening to us, let us know. Let us know when and where you listen to us. It's always great to hear from you guys. Just makes our day.
That was a lot of calls to action. All I have to say is, I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your host, Duncan Nicol.
So long.
Bye.